Hello and welcome back to InfraDig, the podcast service brought to you by IJ Global, Infrastructure Journal. My name is Angus Leslie Melville, Editorial Director of IJ Global, and I have with me Hamish Lee Wilson, partner at Ignio Infrastructure Partners. Hamish, welcome to InfraDig.
Hello.
Good to have you here. Okay, let's kick this off in the normal way. Hamish, can you please tell us a bit about yourself and the role that you play at Ignio? Bearing in mind, brevity, it's an art form.
Okay, following your instructions. The job we do is very simple. We raise capital from investors, find great assets to buy, make them better, sell them, and hopefully return more capital than we started with to our investors. I'm involved with each of those aspects of our business. I'm one of the five partners in our European team.
Excellent. And all of that in the infrastructure and energy space?
Yes. And I tend to focus on energy transition assets. So two of the businesses I work with very closely are in that space. So Infineon, which is an energy from waste platform in the UK, and Finerge, which is a large renewables platform in Iberia.
Splendid. We're going to be talking more about them later on. Okay, so now we know who you are and we understand the role you play at Ignio. Let's lay out the plan for today's podcast. You're going to be talking to us about a proactive and long-term investment approach to supporting the infrastructure's industry's transition to net zero. So let's start off with this. Can you please explain why long-term investing is key to global energy transition?
Well, I think you provided the answer in your question, really. It's transition takes time. This is not about flicking a switch and assuming everything's going to be different overnight. I think it's really important that investors will put aside capital, will invest repeatedly to take a business forward, and you can't reap the benefits of transition without taking time for that investment.
Yeah, it's not a quick turnaround, is it? You've got to invest the time, effort, and dare I say, money in transforming assets.
And you know, our approach in this area is very, some people take the approach of excluding certain types of assets. They don't want to get involved in situations where there are emissions or there is more of a sort of legacy asset feel to a situation. We take the opposite approach and actually say, they're the type of situations we like because you can invest, you can transform, and then you can get the value benefit of that investment process. And so that whole improvement rather than exclusion is a focus that we have across our portfolio.
Okay, thank you for that. Now, let's drill down a bit more. From our discussions prior to this recording, you were talking about the role of investors in enabling portfolio companies to transition. How about you spend a little while explaining this thesis?
I think it's a couple of areas. So the key one is you've got to have that ambition. You've got to have that strategy and vision over time to say, this is where we're going to take a certain business. At Infineon, the energy from waste business I mentioned, when we first acquired the two companies that we put together to create that platform, the mindset and thinking of the business was all focused very short term on let's get these things built and operational. When you try to have a conversation about what may or may not happen in 5 or 10 years' time with the management team, it was impossible. There was no traction there at all because previous owners were so focused on delivery. We've got a very clear view of where we want to go in 5, 10, 15 years' time. And without that, you're not going to be able to then raise capital to execute on these growth plans. So I think that the strategy is key. Timing is absolutely key, and having, it's a bit of a strange phrase, but patient capital, I like it in the fact that it means we're going to be around for a significant amount of time. It doesn't really make sense because we're incredibly impatient for change and want things to happen sooner rather than later, but having that time horizon is important. And then we've already mentioned a few times actually having capital. We love situations where we can actually bring debt and equity to a situation to really transform a business and turbocharge that growth over time. Time and time again, it's lack of funding that means that investments are not made and progress is not being made with businesses and value is just not being created.
Mm. And that's what you're bringing to the table.
Absolutely.
Okay, I think you explained that well. Let's move on to the next point. Everyone is obsessed these days with measuring impact, and infrastructure funds are no different. Can you please give us a view on how targets and measurement are important to delivering better transition outcomes for investors?
Well,
explain that.
Yeah. I will try to. So I've actually got a colleague who his favorite phrase is what gets measured gets done and what gets incentivized gets done first. And he talks a load of rubbish about a load of things, but I think this is one area where I completely agree with him. You have to track your progress over time. You have to, first of all, start with that ambition, that vision about where you want to go. And then you have to track your progress against that. And some of these things will take 5-10 years to get there. There will be lots of little steps building up to big investments and then big change, but you have to be tracking things over time. So we're very careful about what we measure and then being completely transparent about that and publishing things and holding people to account as well. We hold ourselves to account with our investor base, and we make sure that we hold our management teams to account as well to deliver those. And that means having incentives directly linked to performance against those measures.
Mm. Makes perfect sense to me, incentivizing people while achieving something rather splendid.
Absolutely.
Okay. Okay, that's all fair and good, but let's move on to some real-world examples, and you've already been mentioning some, and we're going to be talking about two of them in a second. One of the real-world examples, let's first focus on your German utilities company, MVV. From our conversations, again, prior to this conversation, you were telling me that MVV has a plan to be climate positive by 2035. Now that's quite a transformation, isn't it? Can you tell us how are you going about achieving this transformation?
Yeah, it is a huge transformation, especially given the business that MVV is. So maybe if I start there. It's a multi-utility based in and around Mannheim in Germany, where we've partnered with the city of Mannheim to run this business. It does all sorts of things. So you have a lot of regulated utility assets in there, whether that's electricity, gas, a bit of data as well. You have a lot of heat distribution. You have energy from waste, some renewables. And then you have some supply elements, some electricity generation from non-renewable sources. And then you also have the heat generation as well. Again, some of that from non-renewable sources. So,
Would you care to define the non-renewable sources?
Well, absolutely. And this is a really nice example of somewhere where exclusion meant that a lot of bidders who were looking at this investment opportunity said, no, we don't want to participate because MVV has got an indirect minority stake in a coal generation plant that generates some of the heat and electricity that goes into the distribution grid, heat distribution grid. And that put off some bidders completely from the process. We said, okay, there's a credible plan to transition away from that coal generation and away from the gas CCGT to renewables over time. I think one of the key reasons why we were actually successful in the acquisition is that as part of our bid, when it came to engaging with the management team and the partner, the city of Mannheim, we accelerated the investment program and said, actually, we're not going to do it by the date that the previous owners and management team have put down. we're going to bring that forward. And so we said, we're going to forego some distributions in the near term to make more investments to take that coal power station offline earlier. Mm-hmm. And that was definitely a deciding factor when it came to who the management team and who the other partner wanted to work with to own the business going forward.
Yes, yeah, so it's a strong story, isn't it? You know, not everything can be virtuous from the get-go, but moving towards a position where there is virtue is laudable. It stacks up.
There's virtue and there's value. Maybe that should be a tagline of ours. but it's you know, I'm joking about it. But it's the value we're here for. It's not mm-hmm. we're not a an investor who is purely focused on green goals. You know, mm-hmm. we are measured on investment performance for our investors, and so that is the single most important thing for us. But what's quite interesting about with MVV, there is real alignment between what's good for the business, what's good for the environment, and what's good for our investors as well. And this has really been accelerated after Russia invaded Ukraine, the desire for Germany to wean itself off any hydrocarbons coming from Russia, you know, immediately, means that not only previously this was important, now this is everything, right? This is everything for the whole economy. So the support, the encouragement, whether it's policy or subsidy support to make this happen, has come flooding in. So we've actually accelerated the plan that we put in place at acquisition. We're now looking to reduce our direct emissions by 80%. By 2030, and then actually become climate positive by 2035. And that means that we're removing more CO2 from the air than we're generating. So we're a net carbon removal business. So that means all of our electricity is generated through renewable energy, and all of our heat is generated through renewable energy as well. And that's biomass, that's going to be some traditional solar and wind, and it's going to be some huge heat exchangers in the river. The largest heat pumps anywhere in Europe will be operating in Mannheim. So really exciting investment plan. The CapEx, you know, as you said, these things are expensive. The plan has gone from a 3 billion to a 7.5 billion euro investment plan over the next decade.
Oh, blimey.
But we see this as being incredibly value accretive. Mm-hmm. We've got some very exciting interest in the business to help fund this. Mm-hmm. And we're already seeing the benefits of this coming through to the bottom line.
Maybe a rebrand is in order. Some Mannheim Virtue and Value, MVV.
Maybe, that's very nice. I'll pitch it to the team.
Okay, let's move on to one of your other companies, Nordion Energy. Now, Nordion, it's already been recognized by IJ Global with an ESG award, so it's one we're really rather familiar with. But can you tell us about how you transitioned a traditional natural gas distribution operator to become what some people have been kind enough to describe as the go-to partner in Sweden's energy transition?
Well, very kind people describe us as. Thank you.
Might have been your marketing person.
Yeah, look, so Nordion, again, a platform that we built in Sweden, a business very much started in gas, natural gas distribution and transmission. We own virtually the entire network across the country. That has been built upon in subsequent acquisitions going into electricity distribution as well. So it gives us a really good, solid, sizable, regulated asset to grow from. And that growth will come in different areas. If we start in the legacy part of the business, the gas distribution side, when we bought the business, all of that was natural gas running through the pipes. We're now at about 35% biogas or biomethane. And there is a plan in place to be, by the end of the decade, So not too long, 6 years to go, that is 100% biogas running through the grid.
Goodness, that's very good.
And that will be the first grid in a significant country like Sweden, anywhere in the world, that will be 100% biogas.
Right.
And that you know, most of the biogas at the moment is actually comes from Denmark. It's injected into the grid there and comes across the connection point. But over time, the industry is growing up in Sweden, and you know, part of our job is to facilitate that growth in the industry. We need to run in lines to connect to farmers developing these assets. We need to be lobbying and making sure that the policy support is in place for biogas production across the country. And we need to be working together as an industry. And so that is really important when it comes to the end users, in terms of our customers, the grid customers, the big industrial users. We want to be making sure that they can contract directly with, so they're only effectively only acquiring and using biogas for their production. And they see additional value in that. So we're changing the contracting structure to allow that to happen as well.
Well, there we go. Okay, let's move to warmer climes. The Iberian Peninsula. Now, last March, that's 2023, for those of you who are wondering. Now, Igneo added your 14th asset to the Finnerge Renewables platform. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that since 2015, Igneo has grown the portfolio from 642 megawatts of attributable capacity to almost 2 gigawatts. Now, that's a chunky portfolio, if I've got my numbers right. Do you have plans to grow that more, or are you topped out for the region? What are your plans with the Iberian Peninsula and Finnerge?
I'm glad that you've been keeping such a careful eye on that, Angus. I'm impressed.
The numbers are right.
yes, no, they were absolutely right. It's been quite a journey over the years, and a really interesting process to effectively start with just the assets and the small management team to grow that team, to put in place the operational heft of what is now a very significant player in that market. So last year, we produced about 8% of all the electricity that was consumed in Portugal. That's not 8% of renewables, that's 8% of all electricity. So pretty significant on a national scale now. Do we have plans to grow more? Yes, we do. We're definitely in the market. One of the big things that we've been working on over the last 5 or 6 years has been pivoting away from only looking at brownfield acquisitions and growing through M&A to actually starting to develop assets and new sites on our own. So we built a quite significant development team and have a pipeline of another few gigawatts of capacity, both in Portugal and Spain, and both in wind as well as solar. And part of that pipeline is actually looking at some of our existing assets, the older ones, and looking how and when are we going to repower them, tear them down, replace them with far larger, more efficient machines. And then how do we pair the wind assets with solar assets as well and just make maximum use out of that connection point. So when it's not windy, we can be using the solar to generate electricity and inject into the grid. And then you go along the chain and say, okay, what happens if it's windy and sunny? Then at some point you're going to need some energy storage and put some batteries on there as well. So it's really interesting the way the renewables market has developed, in that the connection point, the grid capacity, that connection point, that's where the value is. And if you've got a big portfolio of those connection points, you can really build from that and extract a lot of value over time.
But at the end, you brought in a whole new team for the greenfield development, because that's just a completely different skill set and experience on the ground of people that actually know that are known locally and can drive projects from that early stage. It's that's quite a commitment.
Yeah, it's a really different mindset, I think. Operational is about incremental improvements. It's about driving that availability and making sure everything, your uptime is maximized. There's some on the cost side of things, but quite a lot of that is contracted long-term. But it's about incremental improvements. Development that's about entrepreneur, you know, going out there, finding the land, finding the connection points. It's about, you know, having your fingers in lots of pies, looking at lots of different options. And, you know, not all of these projects are going to work. There's quite a rate of, what's the phrase?
Attrition.
Attrition. Yes. Thank you. There's a rate of attrition. So you've got to be looking at a lot of opportunities, but we're seeing some of our first sites, come online, actually this year. So, it's really satisfying to see something that has started from nothing to develop an asset and see the turbine spinning.
Yeah. Talking about turbine spinning, the vast majority of that portfolio, am I right in thinking it's solar?
No, actually the majority is wind.
Right, yeah. Okay, I got that the wrong way around then. So the majority is wind, and where do you see the greenfield side? Is it going to be more solar or wind, or is it just as opportunity comes along?
It's a lot easier to build solar. So a lot more people are building solar, and we're seeing the market being flooded with that. I think then that really impacts how much you can sell your electricity for, because pretty much all of the solar is operating at the same time. And so you get that duck curve of prices throughout the day. Because we're about 80% on wind at the moment, there's definitely more that we can do in solar. Mm-hmm. But I think over time, our portfolio will always remain skewed towards wind.
Mm-hmm. And that's quite a lot of exposure to two different countries. Are you comfortable with that? I mean, I'm not going to go on about the Spanish history with renewables. Let's put that behind us. I think that's long since buried. Hopefully, never to be unearthed, ever. It's quite a lot of exposure to two different countries. Is that something you're entirely comfortable with?
Yes, it is. I think if you go back far enough in any country, there have been problems with tariff regimes and subsidies getting changed. I think how it was dealt with in Portugal, when was that, 2013, 14, was in a very collaborative way with industry. It was effectively people could choose to participate in a slight reduction in their feed-in tariff for an extension of the back end of it. It made sense economically from an NPV perspective. So the entire industry said yes. Now new assets being built, everything's being built on PPAs or running on merchant exposure. So you don't have that leaning on the government for the price support mechanisms. Mm-hmm. And then in terms of the size of the business and the size of our funds, I think it sits quite nicely within our portfolio. We did last year sell 25%. Of the equity in Finnerge. We were in a process for that as one of our earlier funds was coming to maturity. And so we welcomed AXA as an investor into the group. So I think going through a process like that does give you confidence and faith that there's a market out there for people who want to come into sort of significant operational platforms that give you that blend between nice, solid, contracted, operational portfolio that kicks off a 300 million euro plus EBITDA and then has the growth potential of more solar, more wind, the repowering. We're even looking at some floating solar in the Portuguese market where we've won some concessions there as well. So lots of exciting things ahead of Finnerge.
Okay. And by bringing in an extra equity player, it does stand up the overall value of the portfolio that immediate time.
Yes, exactly. It proves the value allows us to recycle capital when we need to.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, let's move on to another sector that's close to your heart, carbon capture and storage technology. Now, I've always been a tad reticent about CCS, and I did a podcast a little while back on the subject with Dan Carter from Wood. It's really good. Anybody who's interested in CCS, dig it out. Now, to my mind, this was a compelling listen, and I came away from it feeling CCS was a lot more advanced than I previously believed it to be. However, I'm only really won over when you see project finance structure being attached to things like CCS. It really makes it, it feels to me like it's come of age when you see that. One of your companies, Infinium, recently announced that it's investing in CCS technology to decarbonize unrecyclable waste and generate more than 90 megawatts of baseload homegrown carbon negative power. Can you tell us a bit more about these plans?
I can. So at the moment, Infinium processes over 2 million tons of waste a year, and that waste is generated from commercial and industrial users and domestic users as well. That waste can either be, first of all, everything that can be recycled from it is recycled. And then what's left over, you've basically got three options. You can send it abroad and make it someone else's problem. You can bury it in the ground and make it your children's problem in landfill. Or you can put it, process it through energy from waste plants. And that's what Infinium does. So we get paid very long-term contracts with no volume risk. We have the waste coming in. We then process that waste, generate electricity, which is sold into the market, and some long-term, some CFD. We generate heat that's sold to big industrial off-takers. The ash that falls through the grate, the metals are stripped out of that, they're sold, and then the ash is reused as a building material. And so the only bit of the process that we don't actually make any money on is the emissions that go up the stack. Mm. And so the CO2 emissions, which are significant across the portfolio, that's the bit that we're working on now and in the future. And that's the bit that CCS will really focus on.
Yeah.
So what we're looking at here is, I think, really moving on the argument that used to be, well, if this business did not exist, the counterfactual is the waste would have gone to landfill and we'd have to generate this electricity and this heat from other sources. Mm-hmm. Now, that argument stacks up in the way that we have about a million tons a year of CO2 equivalent emissions from Infinium today. The counterfactual is 1.6 million tons. Mm-hmm. So on a net basis, we're 600,000 tons better. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That the math stacks up and the science holds in all of that. Mm-hmm. But personally, I think that's a bit of an argument of the past. And actually going forward, it's not about relative emissions. It's going to be about absolute emissions. Mm-hmm. And when you're starting to see things like the ETS, the emissions trading scheme coming in Europe and the UK as well, slightly different forms, but I expect they'll harmonize at the back end of this decade, you'll see that the producers of that waste will have to pay for the CO2 emissions from that waste. Mm. And they'll have to pay for the fossil elements of the CO2 emissions. Mm-hmm. So this is the second important bit. The waste that comes through is a combination of biogenic, so the organic matter, and fossil, so the plastics and things like that. Mm-hmm. Now, the biogenic matter, there will be no tax attached to the CO2 emissions from that, because that used to be growing a few years ago in biomass. Mm-hmm. Short cycle carbon, so no impact whatsoever. It's the fossil element. That's the stuff that we are releasing into the atmosphere, and so it will be taxed and is the focus. What we can do with CCS, though, is make an investment, put equipment onto that stack, strip out 95% of the CO2 coming up the stack, That can then be put into pipelines that are being built by the government in the various clusters around the UK, taken offshore and sequestered in depleted gas fields. Now, that will enable us to capture 95% of the carbon. There will be a taxed element on half of it. So the remaining half will be a new product or a new service that we can actually sell. Mm. So that carbon removal is a whole new income stream for us going forward. And we'll be able to sell those credits in the same way that people sell renewable energy credits or PPAs in the market. We'll be able to sell that going forward. And so when you talk about project finance and making these things real, there is basically two ways that these can be financed. One is the government ICC process, industrial carbon capture process, that people are bidding into at the moment. Infinium has just bid a project in, and we'll wait and hopefully we'll find out later this year if we've been successful. If we are, that means you're effectively bidding into a RAB-based methodology where you'll get coverage of your OPEX and allowance for your CAPEX for the next 10 or 15 years and a set regulated return. Mm-hmm. We should be able to borrow against that. We should hopefully be able to make it real in your eyes, Angus. And then beyond that, we can enter into the merchant world of selling those carbon credits. Mm. Or we can, if we don't go down the government route, there is the route of directly contracting with people who want to pay for carbon removals. Mm-hmm. And there are contracts being written now. For example, there was a big one recently written by Microsoft in Denmark that I think was at about 250 euros per ton.
Okay.
Carbon removals for the next 15 years of one Ørsted project in Denmark. Now, if you do the maths and say, well, that's 500,000 tons across the Infinium portfolio at 250 euros per ton or whatever the FX is, you can see that that's a very significant new income stream.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, there's a lot of cost to go against that. There's a big CapEx investment. If we roll this out across our entire portfolio, we're looking at over £1.5 billion. Mm-hmm. And then in terms of ongoing costs, it's very energy intense, the CO2 stripping process from the AMEs. Yeah. So there is a big parasitic load on our EFW. So about 30% of the electricity that we generate will actually be consumed in the CCS process. But once you take into account, the CapEx and the OPEX costs, we still think this is going to be a value accretive investment. So that's why we're investing in the DevEx now to prepare for final investment decision within the next 2 years.
Marvelous. Value and virtue yet again. Okay, I think that about brings us to a close for this latest IJ Global podcast. All that is left is, Hamish, for me to thank you for taking time to join me today. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's great to chat.
Good having you on. And for the listener, as always, I sincerely hope you found this to be anything but infra dig.